What's shaking, everybody? Welcome to a special bonus episode of Improv Tabletop, the RPG actual play where today we're just talking about improv. I am Ned Wilcock, your host and GM, and today I'm joined by
Caleb Anderton
and Evan Peterson.
And dear listeners, I'm pretty excited. If you are listening to this episode on the day of its release, that means this Sunday in 4 days is the third anniversary of our first release.
No way.
Yeah, since Jurassic Bake Off way, way back in the day.
Man.
That was 3 years ago?
3 years ago. And so to celebrate the inexorable march of time, we're going to be talking about improv and hopefully some of the stuff that we've learned about improv in the 3 years that we've experienced since that time. But yeah, we reached out to our patrons and asked if they had any questions that they would like us to answer. And we got a few responses and I threw in one of my own there just for fun. So, you know what, in the spirit of tabletop, because it's mostly improv today, I'm still going to roll a die to see which of these questions we're going to start with. We got 5 questions here, so let's roll a D10 and cut it in half. All right, this first question comes from Tetraslash. How much is improv similar to a muscle that you need to train? Do you find yourselves getting rusty if you step away for a time?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. 190%. Yes. Even just starting up the podcast was really rough. And then since we rotate cast members, there will be times and like we all have lives. So like right now I'm finishing up school. And so I'm kind of sort of taking a mini sabbatical from the ones I've said no to, a couple campaigns I've been invited to be a part of because I'm just too busy. And I'm nervous for when I get back on the mic because, yeah, every time I take a little break for a few months when I get back on and record, I feel like the first session, I always have a lot of things running through my head afterwards. I'm like, oh, why did I do that? Why did I say that? Oh, I shouldn't have done that.
I will second that. Whenever there's a break and I come back, it's a little intimidating. You feel like you're jumping into a brand new space again that you haven't been in a while. But it does come back. I feel like it's a lot like riding a bike. You don't really forget. It might just take you a minute to kind of find your footing, as it were.
Yeah, there are certain things that I feel like become a bit more innate just with practice. So like if we're looking back at the time that we spent in improv class, every single semester we would reread Truth and Comedy, the entire book.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very beneficial experience that even though I was doing improv back to back for 8 semesters in a row, it was always helpful to get back in the book and to re-up my memory of the principles. So that is a really helpful thing to continue to do. It's been a while since I've reread the book. I should do that at some point.
Me too.
But like at the same time, there are some of those things that we would just like drill into ourselves. Like one of the things that it talks about in Truth and Comedy is how they would do who, what, wheres over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we would do. The idea here being that we would get into 2 lines and one person from one line would step out into the center of the room and they would start an action, just some random action. Maybe they'd start digging a hole and then a person from the other line would step in. And in 3 lines, you had to establish the who, the what, and the where of the scene. The who being, who are we? What is our relationship to each other? That's the important part. What's our relationship to each other? The what is the action that we are currently engaged in? And the where in the world are we? And once you establish the who, what, where, you've got all of the groundwork that you need to keep the scene moving forward. We would do that just over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. So there are certain aspects of that that are kind of drilled into the brain at that point. But it is still helpful to have that moment where you think, okay, we haven't really established our relationship as much. We should definitely, you know, kind of get back to those basics.
Yeah.
One thing about that exercise too, that I think people might not expect that took me some getting used to, is it was one of the few exercises where we were actually encouraged to take our time. Because improv, people always think of it as being very fast paced. And when you're performing, you know, it should be to a certain extent. But since we were in class and in sort of a safer place, our teacher encouraged us, you know, if you've got 2 lines out and you know there's something you need to establish, instead of like failing, quote unquote, the exercise, like take some time and see if you can figure out a way. So it was almost like a puzzle, but it helped train your brain to sort of look for those things, and it would get a little quicker the more you did it. Because the first couple of times you get through two lines and you're like, we still got a lot of stuff here that we need, that we have not established. Mm-hmm. But then after you've done it 100 times, the long pauses get shorter and shorter and shorter, and you're able to kind of find a flow with your scene partner.
Yeah. And there was a fun kind of variation that we would do on occasion where there would be a third line of people. And after you've established the who, what, where, the third person comes in and they raise the stakes in one line. Whatever we were doing, it just became more urgent. We have a need. We have a goal that we are working towards. And that is something that I think has been very important for me, especially as the GM, is I'm kind of constantly thinking as we're recording of how do I move the story forward? Like from moment to moment, I'm kind of analyzing, is the story moving forward based on what the characters are doing? And a lot of the time, the answer is yes. And it's great. I get to kind of just respond and throw in a couple lines here and there. But when I get to that point where I say, okay, the story, we need to move it forward, or the story would be better served, we could move it in a more interesting place if I were to put in an offer here, I come in and I raise the stakes. So that is kind of often my role as the GM, is that third person coming in, moving things, elevating them a little bit.
I love it so much. I love this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's so much fun. Like, and it seems all so very weird and contrived, but this is the type of stuff that happens in life all the time. And that's why, I mean, in this art that we're creating, it imitates life in so many ways, and that's what makes it fun and interesting.
Yeah.
And every type of storytelling ever.
Yes.
Because people like to clown on like improv a little bit. It gets a lot of flack in, you know, TV shows and movies and stuff. But all your favorite comedians and like actors and writers have all done improv classes and taken like like, you look at any famous comedian who's like writing a sitcom now, they got brought up in Second City or UCB or like one of those schools of improv, because you have to learn storytelling at such a deep level to be able to do it on the fly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then when you're able to take your time to write something, you're so much better able to spot, why isn't this working, or why is what I'm writing not working?
Yeah. Getting back to the core of storytelling as well, even just like the amount of time that we had spent away from improv, like between the time we graduated and the time we started recording the show, we'd been playing a lot of D&D. So we were still having that aspect of improv, but there were things about the format of D&D specifically that had kind of corrupted. I don't know if corrupted is the right word, but had, like, when we started recording improv tabletop, it took us a while to realize, oh, we need to be, there are some of those conventions of D&D that we need to try and remove from our brain so that we can get back to more of the pure storytelling format of improv, because Fate is such a more storytelling driven game than D&D is.
Mm-hmm. Like, players can't invent things.
Yeah.
That was my biggest one that I think I've talked about before on this podcast.
Yeah. I loved that moment when, I think it was in the Tension Builders, where we really started grasping a hold of, like, we can just all throw stuff in there, and then I, as the GM, just have to yes and whatever you're throwing at me as well, which is a really fun dynamic that I really enjoy.
It's very, very not D&D.
Yeah.
I feel like I still can do more work on that, and remembering that we are all a part of this together, because in so many ways we do defer to you, Ned, as, you know, the GM, the one kind of running everything, but that's kind of maybe a goal that I'm going to have in the future, is to be specifically inventing more aspects of what's going on, even if that's not something that you've asked.
Yeah, I would certainly welcome.
We're throwing it at you.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see. That's a good question. Let's get into our next one here. I'm going to roll a D4. We got 4 left. Okay, here's the question that I have popped in there. This is kind of a pretty broad one, but looking back at the past 3 years, I want to know, how has this podcast kind of altered your understanding of improv? And maybe, like, what improv principles do you find are most helpful for tabletop gaming in specific?
Tabletop gaming specifically, and it's like kind of boring and maybe obvious, but the most base rule that everyone knows about improv is yes and. And if you look at basically any horror story from a D&D table on the internet, that's a lot of issues that people have. Is they're like, oh, I want to do this thing, and there's some other problem player at the table who tries to shut them down or tries to stand in their way and block their progress instead of trying to move things forward. And it can be hard, especially in a role-playing game. And it's something that, oh man, we joke about how often Thomas, Ryan, and I have characters in our home D&D games that fight. But we both will create characters, and we both always come into moments where we want to, like, roleplay true to our character, and our character would not appreciate something that's happening in the scene. And so it's a very hard balance to strike because, yeah, you're like, well, the character I wrote really doesn't want this to happen. So it's a constant kind of minefield to go through, but it helps a lot to be more supportive of your teammates' goals and try and agree with the things they're doing. Then you just never want to stand in their way or do anything that would hinder their ability to do what they want to do at the table. It makes everyone have a better time.
Yeah, I think if I were to try and think of what was the most important quality that made our time learning improv so special, we somehow managed to cultivate a group of people who understood the importance of getting your own ego out of the way. I think that is probably, for me, the most important aspect of improv. Like, when you are engaging in a collaborative, creative exercise, improv specifically, I think improv more than most. And I don't know, I think this is also something that is helpful for life in general. I find that more often than not, my personal ego is not my friend. The part of me that wants other people to look at me and think, oh, that guy's so clever, or oh, that guy's so funny. When I want to be seen, that is when I feel like the quality of my performance starts to decrease. And we had managed to put together a group of people where everybody was more interested in just telling good stories. They were more interested in enjoying the craft, interested in improving themselves as performers. That was their focus, rather than like, I want to get up on stage and have people laugh at me because they think I'm funny. So for me, the most important part is, you know, don't try and make yourself good. Try and make the people around you look good. And if they're doing that for you, then all the better, because you're going to look good in the process and you don't even have to worry about it. I guess just one other little thought that I'll add to that is there was an interview with David Bowie where the interviewer asked, why do you have all these weird personas? And his response was, well, I have a really hard time writing music for myself. But if I'm writing music for another person, it's so much easier. I found that to be so applicable here. If your ego is in there, you're worrying about making yourself look good, you have too much emotional attachment to it, it's so much harder. But if you're just focusing on making other people look good, it is miles easier to do it that way, I find.
And sort of along with that, something that like kind of ties in, I don't want to be too behind the scenes, pull back the curtain too much, but I didn't know until like the last couple months that there were people in our college improv group that just didn't like each other. Like, they were not actually that good of friends. I had this vision in my head that we were like a really tight like group of friends, and then I've just very recently found out, oh no, these two people like actually did not get along. But like, they were able to get on stage, and yeah, like it also sort of ties into your ego a little bit. Like, they were like, I'm gonna put that to the side because I'm here to like tell a story and create a scene. And they were still, it still worked. They were still able to establish trust even with like interpersonal conflict off stage.
Yeah,
I love that. I have a point that came to my mind that kind of goes back to what Ned was saying. A couple years ago, Ned and I were talking about the podcast. I remember this is a big conversation we have while I was moving across the country, and I hide it fairly well, I think, maybe sometimes, but I'm a pretty darn introverted person. If I don't have to be talking to people, or especially like public speaking and things like that, I do not want to, which is one reason that voice acting is really appealing to me, because I get to be in this own, you know, my own little dark closet in here all by myself and do as many takes as I want to until I get it perfect to send it to somebody. And that's, I love that. But what we were talking about is being a bit more of a reserved person myself. We talked about how it really works well for me if I get myself outside of that and play characters in Fate that are flashy, like Tigger, or like that's one reason I like to make a lot of my characters like Amaru Kami, or even in if you've been listening to the Mouse Ritter Chronicles at all, Scraunch is pretty out there and loud and boisterous. And I've kind of been doing that to myself on purpose, not for like a look at me thing, but a little bit so that I stop looking at myself, if that makes sense. Because if I'm playing a character who's very careful or something like that, I kind of can get in my own head about all that and it doesn't make for very interesting improv on my part. But if I'm playing a character that is fairly contrary to the way that I normally act, then it makes for more spontaneous choices and things like that on my part, and I think that's more interesting for me, and I hope more interesting for the listeners. So that's just a weird personal thing that I have been discovering and sort of making adjustments for during this improv journey that we've had.
Yeah, I think the idea in general of being on your toes in improv, while it is a scarier way of going about it, is a more helpful way of going about it as well. Because if you're constantly kind of like just that little bit out of your comfort zone, it's going to force you to make choices. It's going to force you to do stuff. It does help to get you out of your head and more just into the flow of doing it, which is cool.
Yeah.
One other little interesting kind of like way that this podcast has altered my perception of improv is back in our classes, we had kind of two categories of scenes that we would do. We had our short form scenes and we had our long form scenes. The short form is probably what you are thinking of more typically when you have improv in your mind, of like the Whose Line Is It Anyway, where they're playing these games along the way. An example would be blind lines. Before we start the game, we get suggestions from the audience of lines that characters might say. And at certain points throughout the scene, one of the characters has to pull one of those lines out of their pocket and read it and justify why their character just said that in the middle of the scene. And those, because they're a bit more gimmicky, they tend to not have as much longevity. They can only exist in those shorter periods of time. But around the time we were doing improv, our teacher was getting really, really excited by the idea of long-form improv, which is more akin to what you hear on the podcast, where we just start with the three players and the swiper is what we would call it, the person who kind of moves the scene from place to place. You get up there and you just go for it. And like, if we were doing really, really well, those scenes, we could maybe get them up to like 15 minutes long and we would feel so good about it. And so it's wild to me looking at the difference now between our classes and the podcast, where we do these fake campaigns. They're 4 episodes long. Each episode is an average of maybe like 45 minutes. And the fact that we're able to sustain that for that long is crazy to me looking back at our college days. But what's even crazier to me is to realize that the fake campaigns are the short form campaigns.
It's true.
And stuff like 10,000 Things and Blades in the Tao Fei, those are our long form campaigns. And I think there's something very special about the format of playing a tabletop role-playing game, where it exists in a very interesting narrative space, where, like, especially if you get into combat, the way that time flows in combat is so weird. Where, like, in D&D, each round of combat is supposed to last, quote-unquote, 6 seconds, but it never actually lasts 6 seconds. You're given this interesting amount of freedom and flexibility to share your character's inner monologue, and then also perform as that character out loud. And I think the weird amount of flexibility and freedom of going in and out of direct performance is a really big boon to the kind of performance that we're doing here. Because when we're up on stage, if you're taking a pause, you can't just like step out of the scene for a moment and say, this is what my character's thinking right now, and then pop back into the scene. I mean, maybe you could do that. Maybe it would work. I don't know. We didn't actually experiment with that when we were doing improv in college.
Sometimes the swiper would say, hey, what's going on in this character's head?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not really sure where I want to resolve that line of thought. It's just an interesting thing that I've noticed with the podcast.
There was one time in my last semester, we did our last show for Comic Frenzy and we were done. And I got a few people and I was like, I want to try and just like go for a long form, like as long as we can. And we found like an empty classroom and it was a lot of fun, but also a total disaster. Like that story was not, I would never put that in front of an audience, but like as an experiment with friends, it was like, I'm glad we did it. But yeah, you could tell when we were like past our usual runtime. Mm-hmm. And things were starting to get weird.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a blessing to us that the fake campaigns only exist for 4 episodes.
I agree.
They go some places.
Yeah, it's fun in the moment, but if I look at something like Ratoon of the King, there's no way we could have sustained that for more than 4 episodes. It was
so much.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound too down on our own podcast, but I think something that makes it kind of special is that we're really letting people behind the curtain on when improv sometimes can go completely off the rails.
Yeah.
I like that, though. Those are, like you said, Ned, our short form campaigns, because you can let them exist for a brief shining moment of 4 episodes and then be done. And some of them are really good and beautiful. Some of them are just kind of wacky and maybe didn't go the best. And I think that's okay. We're always kind of reinventing ourselves. And that's one of the things that's just beautiful about theater in general is at the end of every performance, it dies. And at the beginning of the next performance, it's like a phoenix. It comes up with new life. And we get to do that, but in a form on the podcast where people can go and listen to those at any time and experience that little blip in history. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool.
It's also kind of a lesson to us sometimes that we're not always the best judge of our own work, because I think Ned and I both have a few campaigns that were like, that one did not totally work. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see people in the Patreon Discord who are like, that's my favorite one.
Yeah.
And we're like, really?
Yep.
That's your favorite one?
Or just the fact that in Return of the King, we joked in the first episode of like, if anybody joins this podcast because of this campaign, then so help me. And somebody actually did it.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
I definitely have mixed feelings about Taika's Fun Punch Club, I think is the full title.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
That was a campaign. That one, by episode 2, I was like, what is going on here?
Right. Yeah. I think there's, when you're engaging with a creative medium, I think part of respecting that medium is respecting its limitations. I think you need to acknowledge and respect that improv, it can overstay its welcome if you let it go on for too long.
Agreed.
So where the Fate campaigns are so improv heavy, I think it's a boon that they're short form. But if we do get into longer form storytelling, it is beneficial to try and give those a bit more structure. That's kind of another thing that early on was a good mental shift for me to make with the Fate campaigns, was to realize these are improv first and RPG second in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. We're essentially treating it as an improv scene where the rules to that improv scene, you know, just like we've got rules for all of our improv games, it's just that the rules for this happen to be a published tabletop RPG called Fate Accelerated.
Yeah.
A published RPG that encourages the type of play we're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw jokes online when we were first starting the podcast. I thought we were kind of playing the game in a way it's not meant to be played. And then I saw a meme online where someone referenced like a Transformers court drama played using Fate mm-hmm. Accelerated. And I was like, oh, so that's just what this system is for.
Yeah.
It's great.
But yeah, I think there's, you know, if you look at the progression of something like Dumbledore's Delinquents or like Miceborn, where we recognized that there was something more to those campaigns, there's a reason why when we continued those campaigns on the patron feed that we weren't still playing Fate. We wanted something a system that had more teeth to it to keep it a bit more directed.
Mm-hmm. Basically, you're listening to our playtesting.
Pretty much.
We're trying a bunch of different ideas, and when one finally works.
Yeah, then we dignify it.
Thank you for listening.
Yes. Okay, let's go to our third question. We got 3 questions left. I'm going to roll a d6 and chop in half. Okay, this one comes from Tetra Slash again. Do you as the cast ever do warm-ups aside from the ideations? I've read some of Improv for Gamers, but a lot of exercises in there don't translate well to remote or online games.
Some of our favorite warm-ups don't totally transfer either.
Yeah.
We still occasionally try, but we do warm up. Before every recording session, we do an improv warm-up without recording it. Mm-hmm. And there are a few games we play, my personal favorite, and then I'll just say mine and then you guys can explain some of our other ones, I guess, so I don't hog all the time. My personal favorite is Category 7.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where you'll go in a circle. So yeah, in real life you'd stand in a circle. We usually have to establish remotely, this is the order we're going to do this in. You look at the person next to you in the circle and you give them a category and you say like 7 things you want to leave to your next of kin in your will. And they start listing things, and after every single item, the whole group yells out 1, 2, 3. And they don't have to make sense. You just have to list 7 things. And when you're done, you go to the person next to you and give them their own category. We do that quite often, at least when I'm recording. And that's one of my favorite improv warm-ups we do.
Yeah. One of the next categories might be, you know, 7 continents that don't exist. or 7 types of cheese that you want to eat, or, you know, it can be a wide range of things. And most of the time, you know, people start out listing things that are relevant, and then as the it's kind of intended to get the creative juices flowing, because as, you know, your types of cheeses dwindles, then maybe you start naming other things like sneakers and
oak cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of gets your brain going and thinking outside the box. I love that one too. That's my favorite.
Unless you're Ned can just throw 7 types of cheese off the dome, I'm sure.
That's true.
In a heartbeat.
Yeah, we all have our strengths. what I love about Category 7 is it very much is a there are no wrong answers here sort of game. Just get your brain moving, get your body moving too. That's something that we would always do in Category 7 is you have to be moving your arms, moving your legs, get your body warmed up. And it's just the fact of like, hey, you need to get into the mindset of you're going to be saying stuff. Say the bad stuff now so you don't have to worry about saying it later.
Yeah. That's a very common warm up too. If any of our listeners have ever also listened to Hello from the Magic Tavern or watched Dropouts Breaking News, mm-hmm. there will be a lot of moments in both those where they'll be like, hey, list 5 reasons.
Yeah.
Or like just in their game and someone will start listing. And in Breaking News, they always like throw up fingers. But in Hello from the Magic Tavern, the whole table actually starts going 1, 2, 3.
It's also a great exercise for yes anding what your fellow players are saying, no matter how crazy it is.
Yeah.
You yell out the number.
One that we do a lot, the one that we do more than any other game for I Cast Fireball, because this is Thomas's favorite, is Hotspot.
What doesn't work remote for me? And I don't know why Thomas loves it so much.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite.
So I have learned to appreciate Hotspot. I didn't really enjoy it either, but the shtick with Hotspot is one person starts in the center of the circle and they are in the hot spot. The floor is magma. The sun is shining on them. They are burning up and they are singing a song. And what you have to do is you have to save them by jumping onto the hot spot by singing a different song. So you got one person in and they start singing Uptown Girl by Billy Joel. And you're on the sidelines thinking, well, my favorite Billy Joel song is Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. So you jump and you tag them out. You start singing Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. And then one person thinks Italian food.
When the moon hits your eye like
that's
a
what
big
I thought of.
Pizza pie.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole shtick is you just want to make sure that the person in the center isn't burning up in the hot spot. And with I Cast Fireball, we've managed to find a way to somehow make it flow online. It was difficult to get into that mode, but it's very helpful. That one, we have a lot of pent-up song energy in the I Cast Fireball crew that if we don't get it out at the beginning, it finds its way out while we're recording. So that one's very helpful for that group.
That's funny.
You've been caught up in the crossfire.
Yeah, crossfire.
I always struggled with that one just because, like, I feel like this isn't a unique thing. It's a human being thing, and I don't get it. I can't think of another song while someone is singing a current song into my ears. Like, my brain will start to be like, oh yeah, there's that one song. But then the melody, I'm like, stop singing. I can't think of the melody. I can't. And I like freeze up so bad.
Man, my ADHD has no problem thinking of other songs while somebody else is singing. And that's not the issue. I just don't like getting up and singing in front of people when I'm not planning on doing it.
Yeah, and Christian absolutely hates singing, so.
But Thomas Brower loves it.
So much. See, Caleb, could you explain the rules to One Word Story to our listeners?
Yes, I love this one. This is one that I do with my middle schoolers that I train in the ways of improv. Basically, you go around the circle, or, you know, in order between all of you, and tell an entire story one word at a time. So if I say once, Evan will say upon, Ned will say a, and then I'll be back at time. And you will just work your way around. And the goal is to tell a story that is somewhat coherent. So you kind of all have to get on.
Somewhat coherent.
Yeah, I mean, it always ends up a little wonky. But you kind of have to get on the same brainwaves as your fellow players. You also have to be listening, and you have to pay attention to what was said before, because if they just said pirate, and you then come in with a word that is unrelated to that or doesn't work in the sentence, it kind of throws everything off.
Yeah, this is super helpful in a couple ways. One is making you throw away preconceived notions,
mm-hmm.
because maybe the story is going, once upon a time, there was a... And you think, well, maybe it is a cow, but then the person right in front of you doesn't say cow, they say stockbroker. And now you have to forget the story about the cow that you were thinking you were going to tell. You have to tell a story about a stockbroker now.
And that happens with every other word, basically, where you think it's going one place and somebody has the power to completely change the direction, and you need to accept that as the new reality and not try to shoehorn your own ideas into where this story is going.
It's also, for me, a great game to tie back into what Ned was saying about ego. It glorifies supporting players, that game, because... You know, you're going to need a the and an a.
Yes.
Like, there once was a stockbroker. Like, you're going to have to be the guy every once in a while. You're going to have to be the guy. And, you know, it's going to be somebody else that might get to say the funny word that finishes the joke, or, you know, the thing that makes the story more interesting. You know, once upon a time, there was a. That's building up. There's one player who gets to have that glory moment. And it's not always going to be you, and that's okay.
But here's the thing. The story doesn't go anywhere if you don't have those us and thes mm-hmm. ands and things like that. It just comes to a complete halt. So I do think it's a really good example of the fact that you need everybody, no matter what. It's a team effort.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate every small part.
Yeah, because the story once upon stockbroker doesn't exactly make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those are a few games that you can try out with your friends online. Another one that I'll throw in there that we've started doing with ICAST Fireball, we actually never played this in Comic Frenzy back in the day. I actually discovered it from Dropout in one of the Game Changer episodes they were doing. It's called Mind Meld.
Ooh.
The way it works is you pair up two people and you have a third person who counts down. So they go 3, 2, 1, and the two people say whatever word is in their head. One person says grass, one person says light switch. And then the third person counts down again, and they have to try and find the middle ground between their two words until you eventually get to the point where you say the exact same word.
This one's so hard.
Yeah, it's tough. The place where it gets really difficult for me is, like, you'll get to the point where one person says cat and one person says whiskers, and you're so close to each other. And so the next time around, one person says dog and the other person says fur.
Oh.
And you're just like you're so close to each other. You're so parallel. It's like that mathematical equation where the line never quite touches, the parabolic curve never quite touches zero on the graph.
When we did our James Bond campaign, me and Connor went for like 5 minutes. We were just dancing around each other, and we both were like, come on! and then Ned and JP, what was it, two? You took two before
something like that.
You went after us and got it immediately.
Yeah. There was one time we were warming up for Dumbledore's Delinquents, JP and I, both our first word was book, and I don't know, JP and I guess we just got some good mind meld going on.
There you go. I love that.
There's a ethereal concept in improv called groupthink, and Ned and JP got it.
Group mind.
Yeah, groupthink is 1984.
Yeah.
Yeah, groupthink.
there's a big difference. Yeah. Sorry, group mind.
Yeah, group mind is what you want. Groupthink.
Don't do that one.
That's the opposite of what you want.
Anyway, you get on the same wavelength. That's a good game for it. There's another one. We can get off this real quick. There's another one where if you've got a bigger group, it's real hard, where you just try and count up as high as you can, but only one person says a number at a time. And if any two people speak at the same time, then you reset the number and you try and see how high you can count.
Mm-hmm.
That one's brutal.
It is.
But you, listener, you just saw an example of group mind when I said scenes from an Italian restaurant, and Caleb and Evan both thought that's amore.
Yep. Yeah.
So it works. It's real. All right. We got two questions left. This next one comes from Nerd Sparkle. Any tips for improving dialogue in tense character situations? She specifies as a GM, but also as players, I think this could be a helpful thing to talk about.
I was just going to say, do it. I have yeah. no good advice for this. It's really hard. But like a couple strange places I've found some inspiration, is Well, I'll go for one that, you know, I've talked about on the podcast before. I'm the resident pro wrestling fan. And this might be a weird place, but in pro wrestling, they cut promos. And pro wrestling's like, you know, 60, 70 years old now. That's like a popular medium. And how do you have 70 years of two guys telling each other that they don't like each other in a way that's still interesting? Like, it's really hard. And I've heard like pro wrestlers in like interviews where they're not in character. They say that like a lot of them practice in the shower, in the car, like because they're driving all over the country and they just cut promos on no one. Like, they just do it just when they're alone. And that's another thing that just for certain like different like musical improv I always struggled with. And that was something our improv teacher said, was like, well, you drive 30 minutes to campus each day, right? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, sing in the car, like, do musical improv. Mm-hmm. Like, just do it. You just kind of have to practice. And like, when I think of some of the people who do the best, like, yeah, epic dialogue, you know, the Matt Mercers and the Brendan Lee Mulligans. Brendan Lee Mulligan can pull an epic speech about anything out of his butt at the drop of a hat. And you're like, how does he do this? It's like, I'll never be that good. And then you hear him say like, oh yeah, I've been DMing a consistent game of D&D with my friends every week since we were in high school. And it's like, oh, that's, you know, they say it takes 10,000 hours to master something. And like, he's getting there, right? Like,
yeah.
You just kind of have to do it, which I know isn't what you want to hear. But I mean, you can also just absorb a lot of dialogue from different places, read, watch movies. And, you know, the more you absorb, the more you'll hear different ways that people will word and say things. That helps a lot. But I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be talking since I'm not the expert on this. And maybe you guys have something much more insightful. But
I think this goes back for me to something that I mentioned earlier, is where I try to make characters that are less like myself than I might be comfortable in, because then I have to really embody the character and think how they would think, so that when the words come out of my mouth, it's more of their words and not my own. That's something that helps me. And yes, I would 100% agree. You just got to do it. Like, I know it's weird and it feels weird as a player or as a GM or whatever to be. I mean, really, we're just all sitting around playing make-believe. We are creating theater in our minds. And we have some shiny click-clack rocks that we yell at occasionally when they don't put up the right number. It's weird, but it's already weird, and we're doing it for fun. And so the more into it you are, the more invested in it you are, the better it's gonna go. So just put aside your own fear or your own embarrassment and just do it. And trust me, it makes it more enjoyable for everybody when you do that.
Yeah, fear and embarrassment. I'm going to bring it back to what we talked about earlier with telling your ego to shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Because your ego, on the one side, it's the part of you that wants other people to think that you're cool. It's the part of you that wants to look good, but it's also the part of you that is afraid of looking bad.
Yes.
Your ego is the part of you that, while you're trying to come up with lines, is saying, is this line going to land? It's the part of you that's saying, is this actually intense, or am I just taking myself too seriously? Your ego, you got to get rid of it, man. It's not helping you. And I don't want to say that in like an, I have ascended, I am completely beyond my ego, all of you plebeians get up to my level. Like,
you wish you could be as egoless as me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, when we've gotten into stuff like 10,000 Things and Blades in the Tao Fei, there is a very deep part of me that cares a lot about how those stories are received, because I have so much respect for the world that Mike DiMartino and Brian Konietzko have created in the Avatarverse, and a deep amount of respect for the other people who are as obsessed with the Avatarverse as I am. I want to do right by the creators of this world, and I want to do right by the other people who love this world. And so there is a lot of me before we sit down for those recordings that goes, is this going to be good? I hope it's going to be good. But as soon as we hit that record button, I have to turn to that part of myself and say, hey, I need you to leave right now. It's hard. It's hard to get over your own ego. But again, the more practice you have with it, the more you just turn off that part of your brain and let the stuff come out of your mouth and hope that it's going to land well. Eventually you get to the point where it's like, hey, yeah, this stuff is landing well. And I don't need to worry about it. I'm going to worry about making a cool scene for my friends to experience, for them to inhabit, And if I'm focusing on making a good time for them, then probably that's what's going to happen. And probably you'll look pretty decent doing it along the way.
I was just going to say thank you. I've never thought of it that way, that your ego is the part of you that wants to look good, but it's also the part that wants to keep you from looking bad.
Mm-hmm.
That perfectly sums up to me what I was trying to say earlier. So thank you.
Yeah, that kind of tied into a thought I had when I first read this question, which isn't totally related to dialogue. But I know there's moments I've had in D&D games where I sort of get a little out. I step away and go, what are we doing right now? Like, like I know some people totally aren't like, and it's fine if you're not comfortable with this. I've role played romance with Ned multiple times, like in multiple games.
Yeah.
Me and Ned have role played romance. And if you're like, I don't want to be romantic with the homies, that like it can affect the storytelling, but like there's times, you know, if your story's got some romance and you feel comfortable at your table, like being able to just like lean into it and be like, nah, I'm like, I'm being romantic right now. That's like what my character's doing. There was a home game we did where we ended up in my character's hometown. And he was like, hey, I want to go see my husband while I'm in town. And me and Ned had to role play as husband and husband. And it felt a little awkward at first. But like, I tried to give it my all. And some of the players at our table were like super invested. They were like, you guys are so cute. Like, I want to protect you now because like, I need this to have a happy ending. But it feels a little weird at first. And then, but it works out if you just like give it your all. And the other thing that I've thought of when I read this is like, less can be more, and you don't want to get too bogged down in like, oh, I need good dialogue, so I need a monologue. One of my favorite pieces of dialogue from anything we've done, and I've told him this so many times, is Animal Station. Caleb sees the final boss, and in his little like low drawl says, I'm coming for you, you monster. And I got like goosebumps hearing him say that, because it was just such an earnest. His character was like, I'm gonna destroy this guy, like I'm coming for him. And he was just mad, and he didn't have to give a big long like epic spiel. He just was like, I'm gonna destroy you. And a lot of my favorite moments for my own characters are like when I get my character moment, when Ned presents me with the enemy from my past, and you just get that little, I don't know, I'm just going to come up, like, that's for my brother. Like, after you're done, you know, beating the boss. It's like, just those little, like, this is why I did it. A few words can carry a lot of weight. Why use lot word when few word do trick?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I will also say, when Evan brought that up to me later on and said how impactful that line was, I thought back to it and I wasn't even feeling particularly like it didn't feel super intense or anything special to me. That was just what my character would have said at the time. So I said it. It wasn't a huge deal, but apparently it worked, and that is all it needs to do. So it doesn't have to feel awesome. You don't have to feel epic as it's happening for it to be epic and fulfilling.
Yeah, I've said it before, but my funniest jokes I ever told in Comic Frenzy were never when I thought I was saying something funny.
Yep.
Yeah.
They were when someone would say something, I would just say something that just made perfect sense. I was like, yeah, this is what my character would say. And then the audience would roll out of their seats and I was like, what? What happened? Like, I just was talking.
And that is exactly what we mean by truth in comedy. You just portray the truth of whatever it is that your character would respond to in that situation. And if it's a comedic scene, it's going to be funny. If it's a dramatic scene, it's going to be dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we've got one final question.
Roll a D1.
I mean, I've rolled for all the other questions, so let me roll this quick. Yeah. Okay. This question comes from Michael Sear. How do you help new players with improv? And then kind of as a further question, is it too formulaic to discuss improv terms and principles? So that second one, I think you're probably going to find differences of opinion on that one, depending on the specific individuals at the table. If you've got players at the table where they're like, yes, talk to me about yes and, talk to me about gift giving, talk to me about relationship and agreement, then awesome. Feel free to talk to them about it. But you're probably going to run into a few players here and there who are like, I don't want to talk about yes and, I just want to be my character. That's where it's probably going to get a little bit more tricky. But I think something that you can do in that instance is, even if you're not specifically saying to those other players, hey, this is what I'm doing in improv terms, you can still just demonstrate that principle for them and they will see that example. Maybe you can even kind of call it out as just like, oh yeah, you remember when I did blah-dy blah-dy blah in this one instance? And you don't even necessarily have to tie it to improv. You can just be like, hey, I thought that was pretty cool.
I will say that when I first started playing D&D, which started after my improv journey, in fact, with you two at this table and a few others who have been on the podcast, I was pretty nervous. I had never done that sort of a thing before. And watching the other players who had done it before just wholeheartedly jump in and roleplay as their characters gave me a lot of confidence to jump in and roleplay as my own character. So lead by example would be my biggest tip, because if you're doing it and acting like it's totally normal and not anxiety inducing, then that anxiety is going to greatly decrease for anybody else at the table.
One other thing that I'm thinking about right now is if we're looking more specifically at TTRPGs outside of our podcast, people play TTRPGs for a lot of different reasons. And some of them are more content to take a backseat. Some of them are more interested in the technical aspects of sort of min-maxing or creating a build that they like with the like rules of the system. There's a lot of different reasons. And so I've seen some like jokes and things online that like 90% of table problems come back to just talk to your players. But understanding like, this is why I'm here to play the game. Why do you want to play the game? What are we both looking to get out of this? Are those compatible? And then how can we help both of us have the best time that we like what we're looking for out of this? Because if you have a play, if you let your player know, hey, we do more story heavy stuff, we have a lot of just like in-character dialogue, is that something you're interested in? And then, you know, they might say, yeah, but I'm just like not feeling, I don't feel super comfortable with that. I don't know how. And then you can talk about, oh, do you want to talk about like some improv stuff? Like, and we can look at like some of that, or like, how can I help you, you know, step out? Do you want me to maybe like almost call on you more at the table? Cause that's a thing that like some GMs will do, but some players don't like, and some players do. If you specifically go, hey, how's so-and-so feeling about this right now? Or like you can specifically as the DM, if like 4 out of 5 players are all arguing over what to do next, you can say, hey, so-and-so, like, what does Gragnux think about going to this city? and get their opinion on it. So there's ways to like try and prompt them. But then, yeah, there's players who, if you call on them specifically, they get uncomfortable and they're like, please don't ever do that again.
Gragnux is my next character name, man. Thank you for that.
Yeah. As soon as Scraunch dies in the Mouse Raider Chronicles.
Yep.
Gragnux. But yeah, just like understanding what they're there for and catching their vibe. And if they want, you can say like, hey, do you want to like, we can get a little technical about some improv stuff. If you want some tips on like how to bring out your character more. But also there are, and I wish I had more off the top of my head to tell you, if you go online, there's a billion ideas for ways that are more subtle to try and encourage role playing and encourage, you know, character interactions. Just as simple as like, I mean, you're the GM, so you have the control to say you're all sitting around the campfire and like you can just prompt them like, what are you talking about? What's going on? Like, you can set up a scene and just say like, it's your turn now, like what's happening in this scene, which can feel a little railroady at times if you're not careful. But if you're trying to encourage players to talk, just setting up times for them to have interactions does wonders, because a lot of people step up.
Yeah, another thing I'll encourage if you're going with the show by example sort of method is don't be afraid to show characters who are flawed and maybe a little bit goofy. I imagine the situation where you've got a new player coming into the game and they're like, oh, D&D, it's like Lord of the Rings, but you're playing it. And they might look at that and say, okay, I'm the ranger. I have to be Aragorn, or I'm the wizard. I have to be Gandalf. And showing them that, no, they don't have to be Aragorn. They don't have to be Gandalf. They can be Gragnux, the bumbling half-orc barbarian who just wants to find his lost dog whatever the case may be.
They can be the Cookie Crisp Wizard.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, it's more often than not, the moments that you're going to enjoy and remember from your D&D campaigns are the goofy, silly ones, more so than the big, epic, high fantasy ones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the kobold that wants to be a chef is one of the most memorable characters at the table.
Yeah, there you go.
No, that's definitely, that's a good point, Ned. Establishing a vibe, because tables can be goofy and silly, and yeah, letting the players know that ahead of time definitely helps a lot. Or yeah, even if you are going more dramatic, you're still establishing, hey, we're not Lord of the Rings here. Like, this, like, you are fine. And then, yeah, showing them the characters that are not, you know, even if you throw in a wizard that is not Gandalf to give them the clue that, like, hey, this is a more dramatic game, but, like, this guy is kind of a bumbling idiot who doesn't get his spells right still.
The goofy characters, in many ways for me, make the epic moments even more epic, because it's like, look at how far they've come.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's the balance of light and shadow. If anything, like, here's another little inside baseball thing. When we started playing Blades in the Tao Fae, I spoke with Evan and Thomas and Christian and said, this is going to be a darker campaign than 10,000 Things by a pretty wide margin, just because of the subject matter, because of the era that we're playing in. Because it's going to be so darker, we almost need to actively try to find more goofy and lighthearted moments to balance that out. That's something that I would recommend for those of you trying to get crunchier, heavier, darker games.
And that's how I invented a pet shop owner.
Yeah.
Because I said, what's the perfect antidote to the gloom, the grim, dark world?
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of furry little critters.
As a listener, I was super grateful for that, because I honestly was a little worried about, I was like, man, I don't know how, if I want all this Avatar stuff to go super dark and gritty. I didn't know if I wanted that. And then in actually listening, I was like, you know what? These guys have found a great balance. And I loved it.
Yeah. For every hippopotamus, red hippopotamus, you got to have a scorpion bat.
You know, it's probably one of the reasons Ned's such a good DM is that he's an avid home cook. And in cooking, you need these opposite flavors. You need the pops of things that stand out. And you need that in your stories, too, if you have your fantasy, you need your moments of the comedy and the goofy and things that, you know, you need your Merry and Pippin to lighten things up.
Absolutely.
And also to provide a focus of hatred for the more serious players.
Fool of a Took.
Well, everybody, moral of the story, become a home cook and you'll get better.
Yep. That's what I was saying.
Exactly.
Well, we got a lot of mileage out of those five questions.
We did. I'm glad we didn't have more.
Sorry, I yammer whenever we talk improv theory. I go off, so apologies.
No worries. Yeah, this has been good. I'm glad to get back to some of our improv roots as we are getting ready to celebrate our third anniversary as a podcast.
Yeah.
Crazy.
But yeah, dear listeners, thank you for joining us to get geeky about improv. If you've got more improv questions, then shoot them our way. Maybe we can do more improv Q&As. I think that'd be lots of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm going to let the two of you get back to your master's degrees that you're taking time from to record this episode with me. But yeah, thanks for joining. It's been lots of fun. Until next time, I've been Ned Wilcock, your host and GM, and I've been joined by...
Caleb Anderton, lose that ego.
And Evan Peterson, maybe talk a little less than I did in this episode.
Much love and stuff, everybody. We'll catch you next time on Improv Tabletop.
You just got me thinking about 3 years ago. I was trying to remember, like, where I lived and what I was doing. And I had completely forgotten that when we started, I recorded this with a PVC pipe frame that I stole from a laundry hamper at Walmart with a thick blanket over top of it that I would put over my head to create a sound barrier. And it was like a million degrees.
I remember that.
And now I have a condenser mic and I'm realizing how far we've come.
Yeah. Yeah. I had my PVC studio thing that I made specifically for my desk with like the moving blankets and stuff.
I also was just in a walk-in closet with clothes surrounding me everywhere, and that's about it.
And now you're in a little room with sound padding on the walls. You look very professional over there.
Yeah, we've all come a long way, man.
Look at that. Thank you, listeners, for helping us to get to this point.